We good? Good to go? Colleagues, could I invite you to take a seat in this beautiful, iconic building, which seems entirely appropriate for our theme today. I'd like to invite you to the last in the series, Imagining the University of the Future. I'm Valerie Hay. This is my colleague, Professor Louise Morley. And we're delighted to see you. Just some housekeeping, first of all. There should be no fire drill, but if there is, we exit here, we go left, and we take staircase, exit 17, and down. The toilets... That would have been so much easier, Sarah. Yes, I like to complicate simple things. We go out. Toilets are left and left again. Please take your security passes with you. The building is on, I don't know what state of alert, but it seems to be always quite high. Yes. I'd now like to introduce... Louise, do you wish to say anything at this moment in time?
I'll introduce Mike, so shall we
Polly? We move on, yeah. Polly Russell is from the British Library and is going to speak to us very briefly about social science resources and their use thereof, which seems appropriate given we have social science disciplines. Polly.
Thank you very much, thank you.
I don't need to do anything, do I? Do I need to do anything?
No.
Okay.
Fascinating title you've got.
Oh, that's a nice reaction. Usually people go, what's that? And then we spend sort of 20 minutes trying to explain. And I think we're about to, we've just are under a restructure, and I think we're about to be termed curators, which is so we're between curators and this content specialist role, which I wasn't going to talk about, but I'll just very quickly say that our remit is quite similar to curators at the British Library, in fact, increasingly similar to curators, but we were content specialists were set up as part of the social science department at the library, which was set up here in 2007. And as part of that department, six or seven content specialists were put in post to look after particular social science disciplines. So I look after human geography and anthropology. Sarah looks after sociology, and might be something else. And our remit is both to try and understand what materials there are at the British Library which relate to our particular subject disciplines, and also to think about ways that we can use those materials to engage with users, whether it be academics, academic researchers, or a broad public. So thinking about research projects in terms of academic use of the materials and or exhibitions or websites, talks, seminars, etc. So that's what a content specialist in very brief terms is supposed to do. So welcome today. It's really nice to see you all. I'm going to talk for about 10 or 15 minutes and just do a really quick introduction to the British Library, to some of the kind of broad materials we have here. And then I wanted to highlight a specific collection I thought that you might be interested in. And then also to give you a couple of examples of the ways that we in social science work with academic institutions and researchers within collaborative research projects, just to perhaps sort of plant a seed of a potential idea in your mind as to how we could perhaps collaborate in the future. I suppose it'd be useful to notice how many of you use the British Library either remotely or actually coming here at the moment. Just one. How do you use the library?
Well, I use it really in a very basic way. I use the electronic resources.
Right.
And I use the books and the
other things. Okay, brilliant. So I'll do this sort of very, very general introduction. It's an enormous institution, as I'm sure you can imagine. It's a legal deposit library, which presumably you know, which means that within 2 months of publication, any material from the UK and from Ireland legally has to be deposited here. We've got 180 million items thereabouts, and we add 8,000 new items to the collection every working day. And those materials are held over 114 kilometres of shelving. The materials are so sort of complex that, as members of staff, we find it very difficult to kind of get a grip on them. So it's not surprising that for users, the collection is slightly overwhelming and unwieldy as well. We collect over a vast number of formats, and here are just a list of some of them. And some of the material we collect is going to very old established collections. So, for instance, the early printed material, which would hold something like the Gutenberg Bible, or, for instance, APAC, which is the Asia Pacific and Africa collections, which derive from the old the materials from the India office. So those would be sort of old established collections, the manuscripts collections, etc. But we also have more contemporary collections, such as our archiving of websites, and some of these collections represent collections that will be very important in the future and are really sort of being worked out now what we're doing with them. So that would be collections like the collections of the moving image, and also our electronic publication store, which we call the Digital Object Management, which is that DOMS at the bottom there. So you can see that this broad range of formats for those 180 million odd items is quite sort of overwhelming when you're thinking about the collections. There are 8 reading rooms into which the collections are loosely so speaking organised. I've put social sciences at the centre, partly because I'm self-centred, but also others wouldn't do that. But in a way, it's sort of reflective of the fact that social science draws arguably more than any other area, I don't know, on the collections from other areas of the library. In other words, we draw from our materials across the collections rather than having a kind of seeing our collections as being bounded. These are the 8 reading rooms that we have, but readers can sit in any reading room and use materials from any of the collections and call them up. It is possible to search our catalogues remotely via our website. This is our website sort of main homepage. And on that homepage, it's very small, but it has a connection into all the various catalogues, but it also has a special section which might be of interest to you called Help for Researchers, which has some very broad introductions to specific subject areas. So that, for instance, there's a page on sociology that might be useful for students, for instance, particularly starting out students, giving them a broad introduction to the topic, but more importantly, giving some overview of what special collections we have here that might be of interest to those studying sociology. And they also have linked with them topical bibliographies across a range of different topics. So I'll just read you some of them now. So topical bibliographies for anti-capitalism, the British National Party, gang culture, gun crime and knife crime, gender, women and employment, migration, public-private partnerships in education, qualitative methods in social research, quantitative methods in social research. That's not all of them, but that's just some, just to show you the kind of breadth and the sorts of topics that we pick off. And again, you can find more about that under the section Help for Researchers there, which is perhaps so small you can't see it. Having talked, that's a very, very broad introduction to the collections. I'm just going to focus in more specifically now on a collection which I think is really interesting and unique and has potential for people working in lots of different areas, and that's the oral history resources that we hold here. We have recordings made by pioneers as well as collections which have been deposited at the library covering a wide range of areas of British life, from colonialism to religion, history of medicine and industry, from politics and the arts. As well as accepting oral history donations of collections that have already been compiled, we also fundraise to do our own field work recordings around areas of specific national interest. And we fundraise under an umbrella charity called National Life Stories Collection. Within that National Life Stories Collection, we fundraise for various different projects over the last decade. So we fundraise, for instance, oral history collections of the book trade, of the food industry, of architects' lives, of artists' lives. Those are just some of the examples, city lives. There are about 20, 25 projects that have been running where we've been going out collecting recordings with people working in those areas of national life. And why I think this might be of particular interest to you is that because that method, the life story method, yields particular sort of material that for people who are interested in education could be very useful, I suspect. The life story method involves interviewing someone about the whole span of their life as far as possible. So the idea is to try and situate the individual who's working within a particular industry or area, try and give as much biographical information about them as possible. So recordings tend to be between 6 and around 20 to 25 hours long, and a considerable amount of that time of recording will be focused on childhood experience, educational experience and expectations, family education. So in almost every single recording that's held under National Life Stories Collection, there will be a substantial amount of material about education, even if the project itself is not focused on education. When I typed in to the Sound Archive catalogue, which is called Cadenza University, I came up with 7,000 citations. Which, what that means is that the word university was referred to in 7,000 interviews with people. So that's obviously tells you something and also nothing. I then typed in university experience to try and just pull that down. I mean, this is not a sophisticated search, and I got 400 plus recordings. This is the list of the 400 recordings that came up when I typed in university experience. And the first one there you can see is Mary Warnock, interviewed by an interviewer called Louise Brody. It gives you her date of birth, and it tells you she was a moral philosopher and a lecturer. Now, unsurprisingly, when you then delve deeper into that recording, so if I click the details button, you then get, I've just taken a small snapshot of this, you then get a long detailed summary of what on every side of every tape or on every track of the digital recording was said in that recording. So it allows you to search the recording, in other words, without having to actually listen to it. So you could then do a much more refined search on education or particular schooling. In this first bit here, it says about Mary Warnock. It's talking about her relationship with her mother, and in particular then her relationship with her nanny, and the closeness of that relationship and how her nanny talked to her and sang to her and started teaching her. And then obviously it goes on in much, much more detail about Mary Warnock's experiences of teaching at university. So that was doing a very general search around university experience on the Cadenza catalogue. There is also a collection that I thought might be of interest to you, which is 15 oral history recordings conducted by staff at Middlesex University for the Hornsey College of Art Oral History Project, with the interviews focusing on the sit-in of 1968. So that is the whole collection. When I then went into those recordings, again, this is just a small example of the level of detail you can get in terms of the summary. So this is a woman called Susan Adams being interviewed by an interviewer, Vanessa Hill, in 2008, reflecting on those 1968 sit-ins. So there's a sort of reminiscence as well as sort of an oral history, which is interesting. But I thought I'd just read out, I'll read out some of it just so you get some sense. And I thought in thinking about the university of the future, it's quite nice to be thinking about the university of the past and how she remembers imagining the university that she wanted back then in 1968. You'll see that the descriptions are very sort of bullet pointy almost, because the idea is to get as much information as possible, to note down as many names, so that just to give the user as much of an idea as possible as what is being said. So it says, for instance, mentions that went along with Susan Bradley to protest about the freezing of student union funds, description of how quickly changed to discussion about changing the college and needing more time to talk, mentioned sense of excitement and awakening, mentions Kim Howells at the meetings, yeah, on and on, description of discussions that took place, and of how SA became conscious of lack of facilities compared to other universities, then shift in thinking about what wanted from their courses and the purpose of art and design in society. Mentions how people like Tariq Ali and Jack Straw tried to come and influence the sit-in, but it remained non-political. Mentions the debate centred on politics, not on politics, but on the role of the artists in society. Comments on role of artists and creative people who represent soul of society. Remarks on strict regime of college prior to the sit-in. Description of main meeting every day during sit-in. Description of visits from Buckminster Fuller, R.D. Lang, who wanted to come and talk to sit-in participants. Descriptions of seminars going on all night and how they would take notes, type them up, print them off. Oh no, I can't say this word, it's a mark of how old I am, or young. Guest, the old photocopying machine. How do you say it? Thank you, goodness. Sorry. To distribute. That's just... I mean, I can guarantee you, if you listen to that recording, it would be alive. You know, you would be there, it would be exciting. Me just reading off a summary, which is obviously just a very abbreviated summary, is nothing, but it gives you a sense of what's in that recording and in that material. And what you can do is search many recordings at home, sitting at home, like this, and then think about whether you wanted to come and listen to any of them, at which point you do have to come to the British Library, book in with our listening service. But I think you can get quite a good handle on what sort of material is there through the online catalogue. So I've given you a really quick introduction to the British Library. I've sort of signposted you towards the oral history collections. I just now want to talk very quickly about some collaborative research projects that the social science team have been involved in. I've been involved in four over my time at the British Library, and I'm going to talk about one that's already finished and one that's just underway. The first one I'm going to talk about was called Manufacturing Meaning Along the Food Commodity Chain, and it ran from 2003 to 2007. And it was a research project that came under the ESRC Cultures of Consumption programme. It was a collaborative project between geographers Neil Ward and Peter Jackson at Sheffield and East Anglia, and then myself, who is based here as an oral historian. And it was looking at the poultry and sugar industries and trying to map the movements of foods along those different food chains, but doing a trying to do oral histories with all the actors involved in those different food chains from source to sales point. What we ended up doing was collecting about 40 oral history recordings, and those recordings were used as the basis of the academic research, so papers, seminars, and a book came out of that project, but they were also deposited here at the British Library and are available now for people to access and listen to. We were able to run workshops here and seminars for academic audiences, but we also did some talks around food and food production to a more broad and general audience. And the other thing that we were able to do as a result of that project was we put money into that bid to build a website in collaboration with the British Library's learning team, who are there, who are the education specialists here, to create a website for school children, students, and lifelong learners around food. So, using our collections around food to talk about issues to do with food production, consumption, food, and its relationship to culture. And if you can bear with me a moment, can I just show you that quickly? Just because I think it gives you a it's a really nice indication of how an academic project was able to do an output which had quite popular appeal using the expertise of at the British Library, not mine, the learning team's expertise. So this website here is found on the British Library's website. It was called Food Stories, and what we did was take extracts from those oral history recordings held in the oral history archive to try and explore some of the issues that are raised by food. So we organise them into these different thematic areas: food, nation and cultural identity, consumer knowledge and power, changes in eating habits, food and regulation, etc., etc. And then within each one of these sections, icons, you get a brief introduction to, for instance, food, nation and cultural identity. And then each one of these funny icons represents a recording with someone talking about their relationship or their work with food. When you then click on one of those, I'll perhaps play you this one because it's Claudia Rodan. I don't, do any of you know who Claudia Rodan is? The cookery writer. Yeah, it's Claudia Rodan talking in 2005, I believe, about the impetus to write when she arrived from Egypt after the Suez Crisis as a result of that forced migration in the UK with her family as a young woman. So you can then, well, before I do that, I'll pull up the full transcript, but there are also sections here, go deeper, for instance, where you, with information about Middle Eastern food, about how food's changed in the UK, and more about Claudia. You then can listen to the extract. It did work. A moment ago it worked.
At that time, writing about food and talking about food was looked down upon. Somehow, food was not a subject. It was a taboo subject. It was a ridiculous subject. People thought little of it. And in a way, to be interested in writing about food was somehow a very low thing. But when I did start writing about food, eventually it was for my reasons. My reasons were loss of a world, loss of a heritage, and the need to capture it. That was such a strong need that I would have, I suppose, done it anyhow. So I was thinking of us, myself, my family, all the people I knew who had had to leave, but then on to also others who had come from Syria or who had come from Turkey, you know, thinking those have to be written down, have to be made a record of. But in those days I wasn't thinking of the English, because at that time the English were not interested at all in Middle Eastern food. People just thought of it as something maybe disgusting even. Because the idea of those countries, I mean, when the English had been colonists at that time, they never ate the local food. They didn't want to taste it. Now it's the opposite. I can say all those things without feeling I'm offending, because I think now it's the absolute opposite. It's somehow gone completely the other way. When I came here as well, when I told people I was researching Middle Eastern food, they had a sort of embarrassed look, even pitiful look, you know, like, oh, what's that going to be? And some people were saying, is it eyeballs and testicles? because there was no idea.
So that's just one extract of 50 which are held on that website, and provide both a kind of useful resource for teaching around various, I mean, I use that to talk about disgust in some anthropology some lectures that I do, or seminars I do with students sometimes, but also there, it's a good sort of bridge into the collections, because you get an idea. I mean, that's a tiny section from what's a 15-hour recording with Claudia Rodan, but gives you some insight into what sort of material is held there. The other projects I wanted to talk to you about is a project which has just been underway since March, which is called Sisterhood and After, Women's Liberation Oral History Project, which is funded through the Leverhulme for 3 years, and is with Margareta Jolly at Sussex University. I'm a co-investigator here, and we have a research associate who was formerly at the Women's Library, Rachel Cohen, and we'll also have a PhD student as well. The aim of that project is to try and create create an archive of second generation feminist oral history archive, because to date there is no oral history archive, so national archive of second generation feminists, and that collection will be housed here, and to use that for a basis of a academic project looking at the history of feminism and of social movements. But we'll also be able to use that material to build a website that explores feminism for school children and students, and looking at some social movements as well, as well as hopefully doing an exhibition for the broad public and organising talks around feminism for a broad public, as well as doing workshops and seminars here for researchers interested in that area. So the reason I talked about those two projects is because in both cases they provided opportunities both for the library, I think, and the academic partner, in that for the library it's helped us build up our collections in areas that would possibly have been difficult to fundraise for, so we've built up our oral history collections, and they've also provided us with new material or a reason to search existing material to then use in exhibitions and talks and seminars for a broader public, which is part of our remit. And for the academic partners, I think it gives them access to some expertise at the British Library, which is good at getting at sort of popular audiences, but also allows them to use our facilities here for academic projects. I'm sure that you want to get on with your seminar, so I won't talk any longer. I hope I've given you the briefest of snapshots about some things here that might be of interest. I'm going to come back at lunchtime, so I'll be around, and if you have any questions, Sarah will be here all day, and you can always contact me, and there's some information on this table over here about social sciences at the British Library. So thank you very much for listening to us, me, and giving me time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Polly.
Pleasure.
Louise now is going to introduce our first speaker today.
Well, we're absolutely delighted to welcome Professor Mike Neary from University of Lincoln, who's going to talk to us today about learning landscapes and the struggle for the idea of the university. Just before Mike starts, I want to say a few words about our conceptualisation of today. When we were designing this seminar series, we wanted to, in particular, to investigate the gaps and the silences in popular HE debates and discourse. And one area we noticed was the whole area of aesthetics and the importance of the built environment in relation to teaching, learning, well-being, health, creativity. We're very conscious that there's been a vast movement in relation to schools, the building schools of the future. There are educational architects, educational surveyors, a lot of thinking about how the built environment, aesthetic, impacts on social relations, on learning, on a sense, self-esteem, well-being, etc. What we noticed was that there's a lot less attention to this domain in relation to higher education. And we wondered if it had something to do with the Cartesian legacy, this dualism of mind and body. So everything to do with higher education assumes that we are disembodied entities. We have no bodies, and that we can simply function anywhere. And it's very interesting that in Britain we are particularly negligent about the built environment. And certainly those of us who do international work will have experienced a whole range of provisions for the built environment. And I often feel in Britain we're kind of nearer the low-income country end of the spectrum than, say, the Nordic countries, Japan, and places that have given some thought to this. So we're very keen to explore this in a lot of detail today. And we have two speakers who have studied this area in considerable depth. And then after the break, we have Gemma, who is going to sum up the series, because we're at number six today. So before we start with Mike, we'd just like to plant a few seeds in your conscious and unconscious minds. So this might be our last seminar today. See, seminar, it's all related, isn't it? but we are negotiating for three follow-up seminars in conjunction with the SRHE. So we'd like to hear from you if there's been any gaps and silences in our six seminars that you'd like us to explore in more detail, and we'll get a series of three thematic seminars. So do stop to think and feedback to us formally and informally during the day. So I'm going to be quiet now, and I'm going to step aside and invite Professor Mike Neary to take the podium.
Thanks.
And share his insights and creativity with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Would you mind if I went to the loo very, very quickly?
No, no. I know that too.
Just be a second. I know I regret this.
We'll talk amongst ourselves.
There's always that tense moment, isn't there, when you're a speaker?
You have to make a judgment call.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm having coffee, it's painful.
I'll just add to Mike's pressure by putting some water.
Do introduce yourself to your neighbour. You bunch around.
Do think about what you want next.
What a really nice room.
Thank you.
So thanks very much for those who made it possible. But compared with your average seminar room, your average university.
Exactly.
It's so quiet.
Yes. It's beautiful. It's sound battling around the town. It's sound battling.
Yeah, on the Euston Road.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah. And it's good for us because there are no riot police outside.
We think that's a bonus.
It's much better.
Right, I'm back now.
I kind of noticed you went. There you go.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
You.
This is what
after all. Yes, that's good.
Right, good morning, everybody. How are we doing for time? So it's 11 o'clock now.
We'll
just
go
for an hour.
We're running a little behind. Go for about 40, I think. And
yeah, I'll speak for about between 30 and 40 minutes.
Brilliant.
And then we'll get plenty of time to talk, I hope. Yes, thank you very much for inviting me to speak, and Kath, to speak to you this morning. It's wonderful to be here in this iconic and iconoclastic building to talk about the issue of space and spatiality with regard to higher education and teaching and learning and research and pedagogy. And on this theme, which is imagining the university of the future. These two themes, imagining the university of the future and its relationship to space and spatiality is something that I, with colleagues and students, have been thinking about for a number of years. Along the theme of reinvention, reinventing university. And Kath and I set up at University of Warwick, in collaboration with University of Oxford Baruch's Sociology Department and the School of the Built Environment, a teaching and learning project funded under the Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning initiative, where we got a huge amount of money and the opportunity to experiment creatively in higher education. So it was a very unique and unusual opportunity, and we grasped it with open arms, hands, whatever, everything we could grasp it with. And so this morning I think the two papers are going to be along the way in which we've been developing the reinvention idea, both at Warwick and at Lincoln. And just to say something about the notion of reinvention and how we conceptualized it, the reinvention Centre was designed to support and promote and encourage research in the undergraduate curriculum. The idea being that two core activities of higher education are research and teaching. Those two core activities are dysfunctional in higher education. They work against each other. Is there a way of re-engineering research and teaching in order to reinvent the university? And our feeling was that there was, and this would include students. So students would become a part of the academic project of the university, undergraduate students, rather than as objects to be taught and complained about or invented as consumers. And that through this organizing principle, through re-engineering research and teaching, one could re-engineer, as a dynamic, contradictory, and conflictual issue, the university, from the point of view of a principle rather than a template. And this reorganisation would include everything, not least the relationship between students and teachers, but also the spaces and spatialities within which we work. We'd have to rethink the whole thing. And Kath will be saying more later on about a particular classroom that we invented at Warwick, which is unique and hopefully will remain unique, because that's the point. But what I want to talk about this morning is how we took that work on further at the University of Lincoln. So, to the theme of my paper, Learning Landscapes in Higher Education, the struggle for the idea of the university. I'm presenting this paper in a moment of crisis for higher education, not just about jobs and working conditions, although that is key and crucial and we must fight to defend them, but also the meaning and purpose of higher education, what it is we're doing, and what is the meaning and purpose of not only higher education, but the university. So that's the context within which, obviously, I'm talking to you this morning. And that's the context within which this research is situated. And I want to begin with a quotation from David Lammy, who I think is still the Minister of Higher Education this week. I think he has a progressive instinct, but he's been rather sidelined recently. But he did say at a conference in London in June that it's time for a revolution in the idea of the university. So I want to take his idea seriously. Okay. So the project itself, the project Learning Landscapes, the University of Lincoln worked alongside a urban design company, a DEG. W in London, and they for a long time, or for a few years, have worked on the concept of learning landscapes in schools. And as you were explaining earlier, the idea was to take some of that thinking into higher education. And the concept of learning landscapes is quite well known in an educational context. And I think what it involves will not be a surprise to any of us. Learning landscapes is meant to incorporate aspects of teaching and learning in higher education that involve the possibilities offered by new technologies, the demand of our students more collaborative and immersive experiences, the requirements of academics for more interdisciplinary research, the need to design more formal and informal and specialized and flexible environments, student-centered learning, more collaboration between students and academics, the connections made with the communities outside of the campus, analysing the whole campus as a learning environment, developing insights from student and other user engagement, supplying multiple layers of learning and experimentation and so on, linking all of this to assessment. And key to all of this, of course, is that it should operate effectively and efficiently. So the University of Lincoln, myself and colleagues, and colleagues from the design company, engaged in a process of research into 12 universities. And these universities were Edinburgh, Napier, Glasgow, Glendower in Wales, Lincoln, Loughborough, Newcastle, Oxford Brookes, Queen Mary, Reading, Wolverhampton, Warwick and York. The research was paid for by HEFCE and the Scottish Funding Council and the Welsh Funding Council. And we had about £300,000, so it was quite a lot of cash. And we had about 2 years to do this. And what we did, or one of the things we did, was that we looked at 12 exemplary new teaching and learning spaces. And we looked at the processes by which these spaces were designed. And what we were particularly interested in was the role of academics in the design and the development of these spaces. And what we found was that academics are increasingly involved in the development of new teaching and learning spaces as customers and clients of the project management process. but not as academics with contributions to make, which is based on the subject discipline expertise. So we regarded this as an issue to be addressed, and an important part of the project was to create a series of development tools whereby academic engagement could be facilitated. And the two areas we focused on in order to facilitate this greater academic engagement as academics in relation to their subject expertise in order to drive the issue of innovation and experimentation was through the issue of research and through the notion of reflexivity, an idea I'm sure you're all very aware of, which we took from Pierre Bourdieu, the notion of encouraging or generating a context within which academics could think about the design and the development of new teaching and learning environments, but in a much wider context of the idea of the university. In other words, to intellectualize the process, to borrow a concept from Monica McLean's book, Critical Pedagogy in University. She talks about intellectualizing teaching and learning in higher education as a way of progressively developing it. And we use that notion of intellectualizing the process of design and development as a key issue. And then the kind of spaces we looked at were, and these have become very commonplace, I think, in the university context today, the notion of social learning spaces, the notion of the example of social learning spaces supported by students. So there are places where students have real responsibilities for what happens in those social learning environments. We looked at experimental teaching spaces, at research and teaching spaces. I think one of the most interesting developments is the way in which universities are developing spaces that are neither research or teaching, but are a combination of both, and in the process are deconstructing that idea that the Reinvention Centre has as its core interest. Technology, of course, but technology wasn't our main interest, and postgraduate provision. And these are some of the sort of headline findings that we found, and I'll be saying a bit more about each of these, but just to go through them quickly. The issue of innovation versus conservatism. Academics tend to be conservative, as do students. The notion of deconstructing research and teaching, which I talked about a moment ago. The importance of service and support models. It's not enough simply to design a new environment unless you show and help and support people in how to use it. The lack of evaluation and research in the sector on the issue. Despite the fact universities are spending millions of pounds on new teaching and learning and research environments, there's very little research into the effectiveness of all of this. So what is actually driving it and what do we know about it? The processes by which universities have or are designing to support decision making along strategic experimentation. You know, committee structures are not the best places to design innovation. The problem of the relationship between academics and estates. There's a good deal of negative stereotyping in the sector, which is very problematic. But we found lots of examples of universities working to develop strong and sound professional relationships. The problem of universities having visions and missions at a macro level, but lots of projects being initiated that really have no connection with that vision and mission. The issue of leadership, which is a highly problematic issue, as you know from the literature on educational leadership and how that is all worked out in the process of design and development, and also the issue of the student and the student voice in all of this. So in terms of innovation and conservatism, this is the kind of remark or quotation that we found quite a lot of in the research. There's a tendency in academics and higher education to be a bit conservative when it comes to thinking about teaching and learning, or because they haven't given it much thought, or maybe they don't have a lot of time to give it much thought. And often suggestions are based on what they've seen in another university, which they quite like. And the students tend to be even more conservative. There's an idea here that they say that this goes back, I think, to a lack of research. People, the decisions that academics are making are simply not research informed. So that's a key point. The most compelling new spaces that we found were those that, as I said, connect research and teaching. We did some research into the Reinvention Centre at Oxford Brookes, because they also created a collaborative learning environment. And they just make the point, which is an important one, is that if we are to redesign the curricula, we also need to redesign the architecture of the university in terms of real collaboration. In terms of support and service models, it's not enough just simply to design a new environment. You need to design support for academics so that they can utilise that space more effectively, so they can feel comfortable with new technologies and with the new spatial context. Evaluation research. It's not that there's not much evaluation around or research, it's simply that we're not really sure how to do it or what, in fact, we're evaluating. The problem is the 21st century dreams are being evaluated by 20th century mindsets, which are not able to map the appropriate matrix to measure the activity and to evaluate its contribution. In terms of the indicators that a university would regard as being important, if we're trying to do something innovative and experimental, how do we evaluate or research that in a way that the university would take seriously, with all the pressures on the university for efficiency and effectiveness in the operation of the built estate? Decision making and supporting strategic experimentation. Progressive universities are designing new processes of decision making that lie outside of the formal committee structures. And recognise the importance, particularly of library and librarians, actually, in all of this. They've played a key role, acting as catalysts within institutions for innovation. Academics and estates. As we know, there's a lot of negative stereotyping within the academic community about different subject areas, and there's also a lot of negative stereotyping on this issue. One quote, the intervention between academics and the state is not so great, the two groups have different sets of expectations. Academics speak the language of activity and we speak the language of space. Although the more progressive universities are making great efforts to work in the context of the idea there's no standard issue academic or estate professional. In terms of the problem of individual projects against the overall vision of the whole university, projects tend to get designed and developed, then the most interesting things about those projects are valued, engineered out of the project, and not least there's very rarely a real connection between the vision and mission in terms of the overall campus planning and that particular project. Leadership, all the problems of educational leadership are evident in these kind of processes between the good things and the not so good things of charismatic individuals who drive things forward but maybe fail to take the rest of the department with them, leading to a lot of resentment, the lack of consultation and so on. But also, again, universities finding ways of recognising and rewarding progressive leadership and designing particular roles within the structure to facilitate communications with regard to this matter. And finally, the student voice. Students are key, but we don't really know what to do with them. We don't really know how to use them. They like to be involved, but they think that they're not involving us in the best way, them in the best way. They talk about the need for training of academics and chairs of committees. So it's a highly problematic area, but the most compelling new teaching and learning spaces are those within which students have real roles with real responsibilities. And Warwick, I think, is leading the way in that with the learning grid, which is not simply about the tables and the chairs and the technologies, but in fact students control and so much as they can that environment, and academics are not allowed into it, for example, without students' say-so. So that was a very quick run through of the cases that we looked at, and all of this and more of this is available on the website that I'll give you the link to at the end. But I want to say now about an important part of the project, which was how do we deal with some of these issues? It's one thing to identify them, but what do we do about them? So what we concentrated on was the notion of research and reflexivity. And what I said earlier is, I think, true, is that there's very little research into the effectiveness of these new places in higher education, and there's a rather good literature review which was sponsored by the HEA. It's on their website by Paul Temple, where he talks about this, among other things. And Peter Jameson in Australia also makes the point of the lack of education, or the lack of research. And a related issue is that the literature on pedagogy and effective teaching in higher education, Paul Ramsden, Biggs, Laura Lard, even Mayer and Land, all the leading lights and work that's very important and important, largely ignores issues of space and spatiality while talking about context and setting. So that there's a problem in the literature itself, and that it tends to ignore this issue. So one of the ways of dealing with this was to encourage academics involved in project management client groups, to inform themselves as to what constitutes effective teaching and learning in higher education. Important coffee coming. Thanks. So, for academics who, as we know, might tend not to be aware of this literature, but to inform themselves about what is regarded as effective teaching practice and pedagogical practice in higher education, and to be able to contribute this or feed this in to project planning meetings when talking to architects about what a space might look like. So just pulling out some of the most effective, recognized effective pedagogical progressive practices are collaboration and engagement, recognizing diversity, difference and dissensus, encouraging intellectual engagement between students and academics through feedback and assessment, supporting students to take responsibility for their own learning, and developing an academic commons through open networked and connected IT provision. So just to give you an example, what might that look like in practice? What might a classroom designed to promote a progressive attitude towards feedback and assessment look like? Well, very simply, it might have examples of the students' work on show. It's very simple. We do that in primary schools, but we don't do that in higher education, where we have no example of the student work, for example. Supporting students to take responsibility for their own learning, actually, not just running the seminar, which is important and interesting, but actually running the room and how it's controlled and managing it and so on. So they actually have real responsibility for the space and the place. But you could design your own list of what you thought was important. I was talking to Kath this morning about a research project she's been involved in on student graduateness and what are the principles of the graduateness in higher education in terms of employability and global knowledge and academic literacy and a whole range of things which you could also use. The point is to use something that is research informed in an academic context in order to be able to have a real influence on what a space looks like and feels like. Because I think what I haven't said yet is one of the problems that we've found is that there's been an enormous amount of cloning in higher education. So we're all developing learning cafes and we're all developing, and they all look the same, and they're all wonderful and they're all progressive. What tends to happen is in the moment of cloning and copying, you lose what was essential about the first example of that place. And I think the learning grid at Warwick is a prime example of that, where what has been taken out of the copies and the clones are the politics of the place, where the students have responsibility. So social learning is not simply about comfortable chairs and bean bags and lots of machinery. It's about something else, and it's the something else. So we want to stretch academics to think and challenge them to think, not persuade them about anything. And the title of that development tool, which you can find on the website, is Teaching with Space in Mind. We also want to encourage, in the process of design and development, a sense of reflexivity among academics. which we take from Pierre Bourdieu, in the context of the idea of the university. As we know, he didn't write much about the idea of the university, although he did write very importantly about the university and what happens in the university. But as Gerald Delanty tells us, it's just a short hop from using Bourdieu's concept of reflexivity in terms of a university in practice to the idea of university. And reflexivity, as you know, is when social science uses the core principles of its own academic practice to examine the principles on which that practice is based. So we're asking academics to think about the meaning and purpose of higher education in the context of their own academic subject areas, to intellectualize the problem in terms of their own academic practice, and for this to be done at a collective rather than individual level, utilizing Bourdieu's notion of the collective intellectual. So again, to intellectualize the issue, because what tends to happen is the project management process is driven by project managers, it's driven by estates, it's driven by architects. Academics are not in control of that process. I'm not even sure if they want to be in control of that process, but they aren't. They don't get the chance very often to design a university or design a new law school or design a new anything. They're going to get a one-off chance, probably at some time in their careers, and they simply haven't got the tools within which to utilize it or to develop it. So what we want to do is academicize the process. We're not schools, we're universities. We're very complex, we're very particular. And I think in order to maintain something important about the idea of the university, then this is the kind of activity we need to think about. Otherwise, we end up all looking the same. And Mona McLean has written about this, as have others. There is an enormous literature on the idea of the university. So Monica says that ideas about the purposes of universities have accumulated and are available to us as resources which may or may not be taken up, even if it's not possible to claim one big idea of the university. The point is to generate a discussion around a very concrete issue about the design and development of teaching and learning environments. So what we did, or what we have done, or what we are doing, is developing... We use the concept development tool. That's not something I'm completely happy with, but it's hard to find the right phrase. We are developing a tool, which again is on the website, is to facilitate a conversation or a discussion among academics and other professionals working in the university on the issue of designing a new teaching and learning environment. And what we have done is we've chunked up, created a series of ideal types of university in order to facilitate an academic conversation about the future of the university. As Polly said earlier, actually I was rather pleased to hear her say it, if we want to talk about the future of the university, we need to know something about the history of the university. And we don't know much of the history of the university unless we are professional historians. So that this process is designed to facilitate and assist academics and other professionals working in the university to think about. So we chunked it up. Medieval, detached and disinterested, liberal humanist, research and teaching, industrial, big science, postmodern, radical and democratic, enterprise university, the student as consumer, that's where we are now. So what is university of the future going to look like? So we've designed a sort of open learning process within which these tools, it's not new to academics, that this is the way we work. We create a reading list, we generate a conversation, we get people to participate, and we come to some conclusions. Again, it's academicizing the process, beginning with the history of the university, rather than trying to imagine the future of the university from where we are now, which is what tends to happen in the context of where we are now. Not recognizing and always, nearly always refusing that the shape of the university or the idea of the university can be transformed, that it can become something else. You know, we are denied the opportunity to think about transforming the university. When people talk about reinventing the university, they normally talk about just reinventing it in the same way but slightly different. What we're thinking about, as we talked about before, we're in a moment of crisis in higher education, and we need to think deeply about the meaning and purpose of higher education, and this process might be just one little process to hook that issue onto. And this process also helps us to think reflexively about the process that we're involved in and to be critical of our own process. So through intellectualizing the history of the university, we're able to do a critique of the concept of the learning landscape. And the learning landscape, is not surprisingly, has appeared in the moment of the Enterprise University. The learning landscape, we looked at the beginning of my talk, what constitutes the learning landscape, and the landscape is about iconic and iconoclastic buildings and the future of every current campus master planning project. They're part of the vision and the mission of the university. And if you put that together with the technological utopia that we are here to live in, the frictionless, edgeless, conflict-free world of technology, if you put those two things together, learning landscapes is precisely the concept that you come up with. So in the process itself, we want to be critically reflexive of the concept of the learning landscape in order to create a new learning landscape. And of course, there's a lot of literature around that gives us plenty of things to think about. Alternative landscapes. There's Ron Barnett, of course. Ron Barnett talks about the need to invent new ideologies against the pernicious ideologies of performativity, the enterprise agenda, the quality agenda, the audit culture, from his own liberal humanist position. There's Savin Bardin at Coventry University, who intellectualizes this through Deleuze and Guattari, and the difference between smooth and striated learning spaces. The idea being, if you introduce the notion of Deleuze and Guattari's notion of smooth space into a conversation with an architect about learning spaces, what do you think you would find? Well, I think you would find a lot of willingness to engage in debates about this kind of thing. In fact, there are books written for architects on social theory, and there's a book on architecture. Architectural theory for architects on Deleuze and Guattari. How could you use the Deleuze and Guattari? So I don't think hopefully you wouldn't get much resistance. You get Monica McLean's notion of intellectualizing the process and social justice and good citizenship, and Gerald Delante's notion of the knowledge society about an open and democratic culture within universities. And then again, how would all that be reflected in the architecture? And at the moment, we know there are many occupations and have been protest movements going on around the world with regard to higher education. There's things happening in Sussex and in Leeds and in King's. There's occupations in California. And again, one can read the radical critiques of the idea of the university that are coming out of all of that, mainly from the students, I have to say, interestingly and importantly. The university in California, the students regard themselves as the crisis. It's not just a crisis of higher education, and it's a social crisis, and reinventing the university is a part of finding our way out of all of that. So is Lamy right? I think he is right. It's time for another revolution in the idea of the university, although I don't think it's the kind of revolution that he envisages, and along with his masters in the Department of Business and Innovation and whatever it is. But I think we can begin to structure a conversation about the idea or the university of the future by remembering and going back to what we are. We are academics, and the core of the academic project is research and teaching. And that through research and engaging a greater sense of research in our own teaching and pedagogical practices, and particularly with regard to the issue of space and spatiality, and then hooking that all up to the notion of the idea of the university itself, again intellectualizing it again and again, then I think we can ground our conversations in the real life, in the real academic life. And while I have no willingness to hang on to the concept of learning landscapes, in fact I'd want to critically deconstruct it, I think it is a good place to start. Thank you.
A very, very rich set of ideas there. I mean, I couldn't write quickly enough as you were speaking. So now it's over to the rest of you to ask my questions in the comments. like to contribute to the beginning of the debate today.
I wonder if...
would you like to introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry, yeah. My name's Vicky, I'm from Oxford Books. I'm doing a PhD in the newspaper. I've had a number of PhDs.
Can you speak up? I'm sorry.
Sorry. I was just wondering if there were, you know, you were talking about students being really conservative.
Yeah.
Your team had kind of thought about how you might engage them in revolution.
Yeah. I don't think students are conservative.
Right.
I think the research said, and people said, the students were conservative.
Oh, okay.
I think we have to find ways of engaging with them, and create a framework whereby they can contribute to the debates. But again, I think we don't want to be overly prescriptive or restrictive about how they engage. We want to allow them to do it in whatever way. And provide the resources and the space and the place, and just to find a way of letting it rip, really. That's the problem for us within a context of working in universities. But I don't think students are inherently conservative at all. I think they're a mixture of things, and there's plenty of radicality in the student voice if we can find a way of listening to it and using it.
Go onto YouTube, have a look at some of the clips recently of all student occupations. Any other questions? Mary and then John.
I'm just thinking. Sorry, Ellen. My name's Mary Henkel. I was just thinking about, you know, the word landscapes.
Yeah.
thinking about what I see was sort of one of the differences between student assumptions now and when I in ancient history was a student, and the notion of sort of multimedia and sort of landscape sort of suggesting. Rather kind of silent, spatial, and thinking about, you know, what are the other kinds of voices and the different the visual kind of concepts, the sort of texture.
You know, but it's very important. There's a richness in various literatures about the concept of landscape, whether it's art history or social geography or painting or fine art. Stuart Cosgrave, the social geographer, has written about landscapes, and when he thinks of what landscapes are, he talks about landscape as being a picture or a painting with a unifying principle. It contains a unifying principle which has human subjectivity in the middle of it. So landscapes are made. That's his point. Landscapes are made. So that's one thing to say. And its relationship between the agency and structure. The second point might be John Berger's ways of seeing, for example. And John Berger, you know, the classical landscape is the person on the outside and rich person or maybe nobody in it. So that's one version of landscape, which is a very orthodox and classical and bourgeois notion of landscape. But then you might go to landscape as painted by Braque. And you get a very different kind of landscape. You get a landscape that is disrupted in time and space and is a critique of the classical landscape. So I haven't found a way to write this into all of this yet, but I'm thinking about it a lot. And in fact, I did think about having some pictures of these different landscapes, but it gets a bit much for this talk. But anyway, the point is that I think we're trying to invent a landscape with a modernist. If I was to say which sort of landscape I preferred, the Learn Landscape project is trying to deconstruct itself in order to create something else. It's a sort of negation of the negation, from the inside out. So we are academics in the university. We reinvent and reimagine our own university with our students. And in that sense, it's a landscape more closer to Braque's concept of the landscape, a kind of cubist sensibility when we're in the painting. Kind of cubist critique. We are the painting and we're in the painting. And we want to disrupt the concept of space and time. And we want to do that in real time and in a real space that we make, that is concrete. So that's kind of how the development of landscape, that's how I'd like to write that in as a kind of theoretical issue into the issue.
John.
John Brennan from the
Hi, John.
First of all, just a little bit of a kind of biography, because something that I started thinking about as you were speaking, taking it back 30 odd years, teaching sociology at Teesside Polytechnic, lectures, classes, except that for a couple of years, I was the guy who some would regard drew the short straw and was expected to teach sociology to the interior design. And one of the features of teaching sociology to the interior design students were that they tended not to turn up for the classes. And what I did sort of, and it was quite radically to address that, was to attempt to take sociology into the design studio, giving up on any notion that they would come to the classroom. I should go to the studio. And I have to say, it was a quite fascinating experience to be in the studio with the design students, and very sort of challenging for me to try and take my academic disciplinary teaching into their context, you know. And and I think the notions of social learning, which you mentioned, were very sort of evident there. You know, and there were very sort of powerful relationships, you know. You'd walk around the place, you would see what people, you know, were doing. And I've always, you know, felt that that was a very interesting experience. And I kind of sort of fast forward now, you know, to today. I mean, one of our kind of sort of conventional sort of notions of sort of landscape is that there's nobody there, you know. It's mountains and lakes and, you know, and stuff. And I think that what, you know, some of my recent research tells us or emphasises about the student experience is that students' engagement with university can be very, very varied indeed. I mean, putting it kind of crudely, one can have, still one can find the residential experience, you know, students are there, they're on campus, they are in some sort of notions, sort of full time in this space. But for an awful lot of students, you might pop into the university for a lecture, in the same way as you pop into Tesco to do your shopping, and it's a very sort of fragmented, engagement, and so I suppose in terms of, you know, I think it's very interesting to be looking at space, but the question of who is there, you know, and are there people in these spaces? What are they doing? Are they doing it together?
Precisely. Well, there's a lot of things there, but on the issue of different types of disciplines and different types of pedagogies, since going to Lincoln, where they have a lot of art and architecture and design and very creative subject areas, they do a lot of very collaborative, very engaged, very embodied forms of teaching and learning with a product that is on show. So, I mean, I came from Warwick, where there's none of that, absolutely none of that. You know, I mean, teaching like this, or on the whole, to generalise, not always, but this is the model. So there's a lot to learn from the way in which they engage, and in fact, the classroom, the cap we'll be talking about later. We call it a classroom, but actually it's like a studio, and it gives you the possibilities for movement and sort of intimacy. So there's a lot to be learned. But then again, I think they don't theorise the pedagogy really at all. In fact, they don't really do pedagogy, they just do art. So I think they have things to learn from us as well. And then the problem for me in this project was working with a very highly regarded international design company and wanted to talk about sociology. I mean, to their credit, they let me, but they used to look at me because I was completely bonkers. And finding a way of doing that.
was interesting. And then in terms of who's there, well, precisely, and that's why the who's there, and in the end, it's not about the concreteness, it's about the relationships, and it's about where the students are in the project. And I think that's what the Redemption Centre, that was the core of it. It's not about classroom, really. Although we want to express our politics in our classrooms, it's about the relationship and really engagement between the student and the teacher, and the student engaged in the running of the university, and engaged in the whole thing. And that's the kind of university we want to make. And there are lots of good examples of that. In every university you go to, there are students running things. There are students involved in the project. But we don't want the kind of disengaged university we have at the moment. That's the last thing we want. So we go back to the principle of who we are and look at the history of who we are and then contemporise it in the context of crisis.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
I was just really interested or really keen on this idea of asking undergraduates to participate in research, and to see that as part of the university experience.
Yeah.
But the thing that I'm concerned about or interested in is how do you get academics and students to occupy the same space? Because my own education experience is one of the divide between
undergraduates
and students.
Yeah.
And it seems like part of encouraging that kind of shared occupation, shared space, asking really academics to be reflexive about their own position in the social hierarchy. Which is quite difficult to do.
But it is happening, you see.
Yeah.
It is being done, and in the Dewar University, they are designing a building precisely on the principles of collaboration between academic and students.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole course is designed around the building, which is media, television, and production. So the principle is there. So yes, these are real issues. In Newcastle, they have the Culture Lab, which uses the concept of debaptizing the concept of teaching and research. And so the point they don't call them classrooms, they don't call them offices. They give them numbers. It's fraught with difficulties and problems. But the fact that it is there and is struggling with this issue in an intellectually informed way. So all of this is terribly difficult, but I'd say we shouldn't get on with it and try and do it if we think that's the way we want to go. And offices, academics are wedded to their offices on the whole, and that's another big issue. But people are wrestling with that and grappling with that. And complexifying a space so it's private, it's public, it's social, it's something else, it's open, it's closed. Not flexible, never flexible. Flexible is the death of design. It's complex. I think what we thought about is teaching for complexity. We complexify the problem because we like complexity. And academics like complexity. And they don't want to be persuaded by some overly simple and banal management idea. That's the first thing to turn off. But if you challenge is complexifying, in the ways that we're suggesting, then maybe we've got some way of moving forward.
Just make a very quick comment. I mean, one thing I think colleagues will have heard me say before, so I apologise for repetition, but an observation that I frequently have about the whole teaching and learning discourse is that it is very disconnected from earlier debates about critical pedagogy, feminist pedagogy. The whole 80s, 90s literature on power, space, pedagogy, decentering authority doesn't infiltrate this.
No.
I've been an external examiner for an academic practice
suite of courses,
and I have not read any sociology in any of the students' work about teaching and learning. It's all been reduced to technology, the how-to, what works, what doesn't, good practice, bad practice. There's nothing on gender, there's nothing on ethnicity, class, disability, which is another big issue about space. So I guess what I'm saying is, what I'd like to see being inserted into this debate is a sensitivity around power and space, and particularly around the structures of inequality. And I'm thinking back to the feminist post-structuralist critiques of experiential learning and the tyranny of the circle. So there were a lot of displacement. We were told on one hand the circle was more empowering and democratizing than the ranks. The next minute the feminist Jennifer Gore, etc., were saying it's the panopticon, it's particularly oppressive for women because their bodies are on, etc., etc. So there was a lot of complexity, and that seems to have gone.
Yeah, well, we want to put it back in.
That's what I'm asking, and, yes. How are you going to do that?
Well, in the report, we have a section on the science of space, which we take from Henri Lefebvre, which we mean the social science of space. And the strap line of that is critical pedagogy as a design principle.
Great.
So we take class, gender and race, just as kind of chunky headings, and discuss how they would affect the design principle of teaching and development, using bell hooks and David Harvey and stuff from feminist literature, and Virginia Woolf, actually, who wrote about education and a room of one's own, pull down the university and build it up so it's only temporary, make it plastic, get rid of all the custom and tradition. So radicalise it, intellectualise it, criticalise it and complexify it. That's because that's what we are, and yet we're faced with these boxes with nice chairs and tables, and it's kind of a disaster, actually.
Thank you so
much. But maybe we can just put this for further consideration.
I think we'll carry on with
Well, I mean, what I'm so struck by, Mike, is your kind of embodiment of agency, your confidence about declaring, you know, the A word academic, the I word intellectualise, the C word complexify, and the D word dissensus. Now, it's not often those things kind of line up these days in spaces where academics get into recognising who they are, what the competences and capacities are. It's the kind of notion of critical confidence.
Yes.
And it's absolutely vital to sustain, as it seems to me. So I, you know, very much welcomed your presentation, you know, in all its dimensions, because it'll sustain us. And we need encouragement.
We
don't often cite Tony Benn, but he says about what, you know, what is he about? He's about encouraging, you know. And I think at the moment of crisis, we need this kind of discourse. So thank you again.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Excellent, Dr. Benn. I'd like to invite you for coffee, take about 10 minutes break, and then we'll come back.
Mobilize, move around.
Use the space.
Take your security passes with you.
Great, thank you.
It's not stopping.
It's not stopping.
That.